This is Ron Greenfield of Aspects of Entertainment, and you're listening to the Handsome Timmy D Express.
Well, hello, dear reader. Hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 19 of the Handsome Timmy D Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show. You could find on iTunes or your fancy podcast app on the iPhone 6. Just go and look for Dan and Travis. Really, really good stuff over the past few weeks on Dan and Travis. So do yourself a favor and start listening, subscribe to that podcast. We're also a proud part of the Chronic Rift over at chronicrift.com, which is a series of podcasts looking to put the culture in pop culture. Just an endless supply of great material, great podcasts, great fun stuff over there. Want to thank everybody. We had huge traffic last week. For many of you aspiring screenwriters, I think, who are on the fence about screenwriting festivals, and I hope that you got some really great advice and insight from the one and only, the founder of the Blue Cat Screenplay Competition, Gordy Hoffman. So thanks, everybody, for downloading, listening, retweeting, and even though we're past the deadline of Blue Cat, honestly, if you're thinking about festivals in general, it's just a great, some great insight and some great advice and some great stuff to think about as you go forward in your screenwriting career. Speaking of screenwriting careers, I am very excited to welcome my first husband and wife team to... Well, actually, they're not actually a writing team, but they're husband and wife, and they're writers, so I think I got that right. Welcome to the Handsome Timmy D Express, Tom Krajewski and Jen Muro.
Woo! Do we cheer? Is this where we cheer and say, yay?
Absolutely. We have plenty of time for cheers.
Okay. No, the audience doesn't cheer. They're at home, honey. Okay. That's okay.
Well, thanks for having us, Tim.
Thank you so much. How are you?
Pleasure. I'm doing fantastic. Great. I'm talking to other writers. What could be wrong with that? But I got that right. You guys are not actually a team, though. You don't write together, but you are writers.
Yes, correct. That's correct.
Yeah.
Tom doesn't dig partners, I think. What is the deal with that, Tom?
You know, it's like... First off, Jen and I are very much like we're too alike, you know. So like, I have a hard time expressing my ideas to her and having her understand them, and it's the same way with her to me. I think faster than I talk, so I get frustrated talking to a partner trying to tell them how I think something should be, and I just can't get my ideas across, which is why I'm a writer in the first place. I'm a better writer than I am a speaker. So yeah, Jen and I don't know.
It's probably why we still know each other.
Yeah.
So we can function. Yeah.
I think if we were to work together, it might be...
We're great with ideas bouncing off of each other, and we help each other in that way. But I think working on a script together, we might murder each other.
Yeah.
So that's probably why. So yeah, all these years, although we'd probably be a pretty powerful duo if we ever got our head out of our asses and actually wrote together.
We are doing something right now, actually, that... We never have worked on anything before, but Jen and I, we were working on this script. I had this idea for the sitcom, and I didn't really want to write it because I'm a lazy writer. So,
that's implied by saying writer.
Yes, right. Exactly. So she took it, and she just ran with it. She wrote the whole script, and now she passed it off to me to kind of like shorten it and kind of edit it. So we're finally working together in that way.
For the very first time.
But I just let her create the whole story and jokes and everything, and I'm just kind of like story editing it. So in a way, we're working together now, but it's not like...
But never before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe marriage. We just got married a few months ago, so maybe now I just have given up. I'll do it. All right. I'll work with you, honey.
Nice.
But now, do you guys write? You just mentioned, so you just wrote a sitcom, but do you guys write? Tell us a little bit about what you guys write, because you guys do have credits to your name and stuff. So tell us a bit about yourselves.
I mean, for me, I started in the animation business about 12 years ago, so I've been doing this a long time. I started in development originally. And then started writing for the past maybe 10, 11 years. Actually, my first job was Bible writing. So Bible writing, creating Bibles for new shows for other people and then for myself, of course.
And Nickelodeon.
Yeah, started at Nickelodeon and then sold my first show in 2011 to Nickelodeon. And I do a lot of overseas stuff too, which is kind of sucks because it doesn't get on IMDb here in the States. But like, there's a bunch of credit. It's like, oh well, I'm big in South America, you know, or big in Europe.
Right. But, I'm huge in Australia.
Right?
You have a ton of people down under listening to you right now. So
really? Good eye, everyone.
Yeah, I just want to quickly. Can you clarify, because something I've learned over the past few weeks doing this is I have a lot of people who are listening to this who actually are just interested in the business, not really involved in it. So can you just clarify exactly what a Bible is?
A Bible is a show. It's a show I guess. How would you?
I always think of it as like a show treatment, like a series treatment kind of
thing.
It's
like, I'd say anywhere between as short as 5 pages and as long as 13 pages, although these days people don't want to read 13 pages anymore. But it's going to be overview, characters, setup, world, a couple of episode premises to kind of get an idea of what the whole show is about. I know they don't do it as much in live action, although I think these days they want to do that a little bit more than they used to. Yeah. But it's very big in animation where you have kind of Bible meaning, like the whole setup of your show and what it's about.
Yeah, no, you're right, Tim. Yeah. It really is like a treatment. And in animation, the show Bible, you know, animation is based on visuals, so you have to have a lot of artwork in there, which is why a show Bible is pretty important in animation. You have to throw all your artwork in there.
Right.
Yeah. With just like anything else you would do when you're creating a character or world. You have to explain it all, show the executives where the series is going to go and why it stands out from other series. But yeah, it's really important in this business is to have that show Bible. And that's what Jen, she writes really well. She taught me how to write better show Bibles because
you do a lot of that now.
I do a lot of it now, but I wasn't very good at it before.
Well, starting in development, that helped.
Yeah, she was in development. She helped discover some shows for Nickelodeon.
There you go. So that's a Bible.
Show Bibles.
I want to go back to something you said a second ago, Tom, when you said, and I think you said something that I think a lot of writers go through. I know I certainly go through it, which is you think faster than you can talk. Has that experience writing some of those Bibles and everything, has that almost helped you with that discipline of, or given you a discipline of how to formulate and articulate those thoughts?
No.
Or should it? Or is that the hope?
It really hasn't. I mean, I mean, the only time I'm good at talking is if I've like prepared a pitch for like, a network. You know, that's the only time I can actually kind of get my ideas across, because you practice the whole spiel, the story beats or whatever. But I mean, I like taking the time to think about it and write. I'm just so bad telling a story verbally or telling a joke. I can be funny, but I can't tell you a story for the life of me unless I practice it. And who does that before they go into like a party and has a social conversation?
Yeah, who does that? Yeah. Only crazy
Tim
people.
Tim Davis?
Yeah.
But yeah, so no.
That's why God invented pets.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Practice. Yeah.
I'll tell you this, though. I ran into a lot of trouble with one of my scripts. It's live action adult drama. Not adult meaning pornographic, just like, I mean, cable kind of 10 p.m. drama. And a lot of people were like, I don't understand this. I don't understand this. And it's like, Jesus, I don't want to, like, they're like, we need to, what's the rest of the series? What's episode 2? What's this? What's that? And on the blacklist, it was getting killed. And people were like, we really like this script. I just don't know where it's going.
Right.
And I'm like, I don't want to telegraph the season finale in act four. You know, this is stupid.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I wrote a Bible that I got 2/8, and people were like, oh, that's where it is. And it's hard, because until you see an episode or two, it's very hard for people to understand where you're going, especially if you have like season long arcs, mysteries. You know, a show like How to Get Away with Murder, I imagine, must have a very intricate Bible.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think that's the one thing I'm so grateful for the animation. If I'm grateful for anything in the industry I started in, which I'm actually moving in more towards live action, is that Bible discipline. I am so used to knowing my show that people, we've talked to other quite successful live action writers, and they're like, you know all of that. Like, they usually go in and have an idea. They don't even have sometimes write the pilot. Of course, sometimes they're at that level where they don't have to do that. But even if they wrote the script, they're like, I don't know what's next. And I'm like, how do you not know what's next? Right. I'm so used to having to know that. I think that discipline going into live action will probably eventually benefit me. Because, I mean, in my live action stuff, I have full Bibles for. I know exactly where the show is going to go. Now, I mean, at least for the first season, or at least 13 episodes. And that comes from animation. And I think that's something I think the live action world should do more, and I think they're actually going to that more because of what you just said, which is they're asking, what's the second episode?
Yeah.
They're actually asking these questions now that usually didn't have to do before, I don't think, as much.
Yeah.
Well, the era of binge watching. You know, you don't watch you don't watch The Wire once a week. You watch The Wire next Sunday's Wire Sunday.
Right.
You just sit down and watch season 3.
Yeah.
Or Orange is the New Black or Game of Thrones these days. I mean, take your pick.
Absolutely, and that's why I'm glad that's the one thing that animation definitely is awesome for.
Animation just it's taught me a lot about writing for live action in general.
Yes,
like you only have like 11 minutes to tell a story in a cartoon, so you have to cram all your jokes into like a 15 page script. And if you want to do that, you got to just edit yourself and down to like the shortest sentence you can and get your idea across with still having color to it. So I think, you know, animation is just like the best training for live action. I really do.
Well, Tom, you've had some, we talked off before we started recording about, you've had some success on the festival circuit this year, including finalist in Page.
Yeah.
And winning Pipeline.
Yeah, so, the script Pipeline.
Yeah. So yeah, this is that guy, you guys. Those of you who didn't win, I've got. But I'm just wondering, though, how much do you think that editing and that parsing and economy of words has helped you in these festivals?
It's done a ton. You know, like before I even entered this festival with the script, which is also on the blacklist as well. But when I was working at Nickelodeon, we had just finished our series, and this is back in 07. So I was like, okay, what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. So I wrote a script, about like 110-page live-action script. It's a hitman comedy.
And that was a feature.
A feature, right. Hitman comedy. And it was so like precise and, well, not precise, but just so, I don't know, I can't explain it. It was kind of written in a cartoonish way, I guess, that I was so used to writing, you know, short, concise. Get your ideas across, get the funny across really quickly. And then that got optioned back in 09. Because of that, like, and that's what I heard from the producers. They were kind of surprised at like how a cartoonist, you know, or a cartoon writer wrote such a good live action feature. It's just because you have to learn to edit yourself and not give anything too extraneous. Yeah. And if you're gonna write a comedy and you want it to sell these days, it has to be joke after joke after joke, and it can't just, you know, can't get old in a way. I don't know.
Well, you have a huge resume in animation. I mean, that's.
Yeah. I can't say enough about animation helping me become a better writer, and especially with the script that was in the script pipeline contest this past year, this past summer that won. It's a, you know, a family sitcom, live action family sitcom, and it's also has some action in it as well. And I think that's what really helped me sell it, is coming from the animation world, because I'm writing an action comedy, but in live action, it still translates really well. So I think both live action and animation are very similar styles, actually, but one taught me how to write the other even better.
Yeah, I think there's a trick in the screenwriting discipline of, you know, as writers, we want to make sure that we sound brilliant and artistic, and we're, you know, screenwriting is not about choosing the most words, but choosing the right ones, and it's easy for us to forget that, you know, what can be conveyed in very few words.
Yeah.
I can't help but think of the alien. I did a thesis or study on the alien scripts this past year, and I don't know if you ever read Alien.
No.
But like the Giler Hill version, it sounds like a script that you would write in some ways, because it literally was like one word sentences.
Yeah. Oh wow.
You know what I mean? And it literally is like alien jumps, reaches through the door. You know,
that's cartoon writing for you. Yeah.
But it's got this bam, 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 and you're reading it like it doesn't actually read like the movie. But you're reading this like bullet point staccato suspense, and you can't help. Next thing you know, you're just flying through the pages,
and you're enthralled, right? Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, you can't help but turn the page. I mean, that's
nothing stopping you from the next page, which is nice.
Yeah, I mean, it also depends on what you're writing, I guess. Obviously,
that's
like if I were
true.
Writing a drama, I don't know how to really write dramas because I'm so used to writing comedies and action where it's fast. So I mean, it might be totally different if I was to try to write like a drama film. But
see, I don't know, because like I write dramas mostly, and that's a big problem for me is parsing it down. I'm very much envious of writers who have a great economy of words. Our friend Dave Ferrari,
his
scripts are like just if it's two lines, I mean, it's
really
it's valuable if it's two lines of description. And there's one of those things that some in a drama you sometimes can have. Like I could almost see a scene in like Breaking Bad where you know Walter White gets up from the table, Sky looks over, she hates him. You know, you would just write that in your description, and you got your whole dynamic for the scene.
Yes. Right. I mean, I think people, a lot of starting writers obviously make the big mistake of just explaining way too much.
Yeah.
So it's just experience and getting in the world and reading more scripts and seeing how they do it that, you know, you just
read learn. Scripts, read scripts.
Read That's, scripts, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mike Sunday, who was on a few episodes ago, talked about reading some finalists and winner scripts, and he gave such a good phrase, which I've always thought of ever since then, is like to make your script an effortless read.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's good.
And sometimes the less words, the less thinking will add to that.
Yes.
I always slip in a $100 bill if I hand my script off to someone too. That usually helps.
Yeah, that's true. That always works.
Sometimes it does. Depends.
Yeah.
Now, Jim, were you writing scripts before you got into development, or that came after?
I mean, I went to USC for film production originally. I actually wanted to compose for a living. I loved film scores, and I'm a musician, but that kind of went by the wayside because I play by ear. So anyway, that's another whole long story. But I've always loved film, and I mean, Spielberg was a huge influence on me. Lucas, all those guys, and Zemeckis, it was big for me. So I started writing stuff before I adapted a novel into a screenplay when I had no damn right to, because I didn't even have rights to the thing. But I was 20 and a moron, and I wanted to do it.
What was it called?
I did it. No, we're not going to discuss that.
Okay,
but it was actually a fantasy novel. But I did it, 125 pages, did the whole thing, and just because I wanted to, and that was before everything. So I was writing before that and having ideas, and I loved animation, and especially in the 90s. I mean, animation was pretty awesome at the time.
Oh, yeah.
At Batman the Animated Series, there was a lot of great stuff in the 90s, especially with Warner Brothers. And there was really fun stuff like Animaniacs and Freakazoid, all those wacky shows.
Well, I remember Gargoyles.
And Gargoyles, which was
Jonathan
wonderful.
Briggs,
yeah, there was. It was. It was fantastic.
That was
so
good.
So no, I definitely was doing this before I hit Nickelodeon. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Something though, I don't think you're being a moron though for adapting that. That's just a spec. And if it never gets made, it never gets made. Because I like,
right?
You know, there's an element of a message of what you guys are saying here, which is one, you adapt a novel before you had the rights to it. And Tom, you wrote a feature when you weren't really allowed to. You're an animator guy.
Yeah, exactly.
You didn't know what to do. Don't wait.
Yeah.
You know, this is not a business where you wait for permission.
No.
You know, or an endeavor or create, you know, your creative artistic arts, you got to just reach out and grab it and go for it.
Yeah. If you don't keep writing, then you're not going to have anything to show anybody when they ask for it, basically.
I never thought of using that as a spec at this point. I mean, this thing was on disc, by the way. That's how old the script is. I'd have to probably like scan it and like, I don't even have it on like a CD. So, but that's a good idea to actually use that as a
you
spec.
Could, yeah.
I didn't even think about that.
Is that not available now?
What is my script?
Yeah, in other words, was this is like? Did you adapt Game of Thrones? You know?
No. What I mean is, it's on disc. It's on like floppy disk or hard.
Oh, no, I just
disc.
Mean the property. Oh. Has the property been made yet?
I mean, it has over the years, on and off.
They
but I mean,
it?
It doesn't matter. It's still a sample. A sample's a sample. So no, it's not like Game of Thrones or anything like that.
I'm gonna try to. I'm gonna, Mists of Avalon.
No, it was actually It was actually Dragonlance.
Oh, yeah, why hasn't that? Yes, dig that out, scan that in. Why hasn't anybody done Dragonlance?
Yeah, it was Dragons of Autumn Twilight, which they actually did into an animated, like, direct-to-video. I think, like, Michelle Trachtenberg was in it, maybe even Nathan Fillion. I don't even remember who was in that. Someone was in that. It was, like, a few years ago, and it just bombed, I think, horrifically. But no, not into live action. And it was, you know, I like Hickman and Weiss, but, I mean, it wasn't, like, Game of Thrones level. But at the time, it was a huge influence on
me. That's why I love her. She likes nerd stuff like me. Like that's why I wanted to say the name of the book, because Dragonlance. Because I mean, how often do you find a hot girl who likes nerd stuff?
Well,
like
they can't see me on this, but
nowadays you can't sneeze without hitting one,
which is absolutely right. And that's another weirdness for me, because I was the chick at the Renaissance Fair or Star Trek conventions where I was looked at with three heads. You know, like what the hell?
She was the only one back then. Where were they when like
so an early
I was a kid?
Pioneer?
Yeah, Tom, trust me.
Yeah, not anymore. But I'm glad it's huge now. But that's a whole other separate
thing. Why do you think that's happened, though?
I have no idea. I honestly think this is the only thing I could possibly think of, which is we all grew up at that time, and now the nerds own the keys to the kingdom, and now it is okay, and technology has advanced to the point where it's okay to have tech. It's okay to be cool. It's okay to have your iPhones. It's okay to have your iPads.
Yeah.
And who's creating that? The nerds.
Yeah.
Who are age now and who are running things now.
But
I
think it's like the reason it's okay, or not okay, but it's more accepted for, you know, girls to be nerds is because of the internet having brought us all together in the past 20 years, where a girl in Iowa who feels like a lonely nerd can look at some girl in Australia who's a lonely nerd and be like, oh, there's more people like me. And then they start talking about it online, and they all kind of just realize
there's more awareness, of course.
And then,
absolutely.
And then girls feel more open to come out about that kind of thing.
I mean, look at comic book movies going on right now, right? And heroes that it's cool. Like
what
football
is?
Players in high school now are talking about Avengers movies. Back when we were in high school, you didn't like there was the nerds and there was the jocks, and now it's this giant blur. I think I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
Pretty
blurry. Well, I mean, look at Chris Cluey from the Minnesota Vikings. Well, he's retired now, but he was the kicker that wrote the very much came in defense of gay players.
Oh, yeah.
And it was funny because, well, it was actually kind of annoying because he did one Monday Night Football. He got a lot of the criticism from some unnamed and not my favorite Fox Sports journalists for writing a bunch of garbage and stuff like that on a Monday Night Football game. And right. So I went on Twitter, and I was like, what the hell is this? This doesn't make any sense. It's stupid, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, he's losing his mind. He's some kind of crazy. He's writing us all this bullshit. And I go to his Twitter feed, and it's all World of Warcraft stuff. He was really? Live tweeting his World of Warcraft game.
It's awesome.
And no, like these old school sports reporters just did not remotely understand it at all. You know, they thought it was, they thought he was losing his mind that he had, you know.
Old people are stupid.
They are stupid. I think there's something too about with the, that's interesting. I remember seeing Charlie's Angels with a previous girlfriend in the movie theater and watching it being like, this is one of the most misogynistic movies I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I looked over to my girlfriend at the time and said, what did you think? She goes, oh my God, that was the most kick-ass movie I've ever seen. And I was like, really? She's like, and she was so empowered by it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because they were women being sexy, women being kind of goofy and ditzy, and women kicking ass.
Yeah.
And they didn't have to become, you know, butch or become any sort of guy.
Boring kind of be, yeah, exactly.
Right, you know, but they also didn't have to be bimbos either. They were right. Clearly intelligent. They spoke four languages, and they were like conversing, like not so the other guy didn't know what they were saying. I mean, that's what was so great, because I love that movie too. It's fabulous, and you know, I'm not the biggest McG fan in the world, but I felt the same exact way, which was fun because there wasn't tons. I mean, the 70s had a lot of women stuff, like Charlie's Angels and Wonder Woman and Bionic Woman and all that stuff. And then it stopped for a while, and then we got Buffy, and then Xena, and then it stopped again. So I'm not surprised you liked it.
Yeah, I think there's been an empowerment to a lot of this stuff that has attracted the female audience, I think, you know. And looking at, and sorry guys, we're going down the rabbit hole, but, you know, Tom and Jen are a bit fans of the Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And, you know, Doctor Who is a real clear-cut example of, it's almost embarrassing to watch some of the older shows where it's like, you know, Polly or Sarah or Joe, the female companions, were told,
right.
no, you got to stay behind, it's too dangerous for girls.
Right.
Whereas you could not even, I can't imagine somebody saying that to Donna or Rose. I mean, imagine saying that to Rose or Amy Pond or
Claire. Right, or especially Donna or Amy. I mean, any of them. I mean, even Clara. So
we've seen a real switch there happen as far as an empowerment of,
right.
of women on the screen. And that is only going to lead to more female supporters and followers, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I hope so. It's just that we need, like, I mean, they're finally, DC's finally pushed to do a Wonder Woman thing when we've been begging for it since Joss wrote his version. And it took this long to do it. It's like, it's kind of like, where's the next Buffy? Where's the next Xena? Where's, you know, that's the thing I'm waiting for next, rather than just the companion. And I'm glad there's strong companions on Doctor Who. But, like, where's the female Doctor Who? And it doesn't even have to be Doctor Who. It could just be some new thing that's not Doctor Who. Or maybe an offshoot of Doctor Who that's not the Doctor, but a woman. I don't know.
Yeah.
Something, anything.
I think Buffy really doesn't get enough credit. You mentioned Buffy there.
Yes.
Buffy does not get enough credit, because Buffy was a show that did not preach, did not get on any kind of soapbox. And it just was, the main protagonist happens to be a girl who can kill vampires.
Right.
And she went through all the things a teenage girl goes through.
Right.
And there was never any sort of, like, I don't know, and for whatever reason, there's that very naturally happened. Like, I haven't seen all of Buffy, but as a male viewer, I never feel alienated from it.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
And that's why it's so well-written, and she's funny. She's freaking funny.
Yeah.
She's, you know, that's not just, oh, I'm a girl, you know, she's got some one-liners, and that's obviously
Joss's strength.
And Joss's, but also a testament to the writers and, you know, I mean, Drew and Marty and all of those guys. So that's what I kind of feel like I'm looking forward to. I mean, that's what kind of the Doctor Who companions have. I would just love to see them as like the hero.
That's also what Jen writes. Like, she writes a lot. You know, she wrote a pilot recently that's about two strong female leads, and like that's like her. Well, she has many strengths, but like that's one of her
right.
passions. She grew up loving Wonder Woman and stuff. So, I mean, you definitely lean towards that.
I definitely lean towards that.
We need
anyway.
It. I would love to see more strong female leads.
But
everywhere,
you, I love what Tom writes is pretty much strong comedy action heroes, which is awesome. And that's a huge strength. I mean, that's a huge thing that we don't have right now. And that's why we kind of love Han Solo in a lot of ways, or Indiana Jones.
Oh, yeah.
Any of those guys. I mean, you know, or actually now Star-Lord, which is a huge thing. And that's what you kind of always have written.
Your flawed heroes.
Which is flawed and funny. It doesn't have to be, you know, Die Hard. It can be, you know, like Guardians of the Galaxy.
Someone I can relate to. Cause, I mean,
right. So in the same way, I appreciate what Tom does, which is bringing that kind of thing back.
Well, yeah, because, you know, like, this is maybe a little off subject, but growing up in the 80s, like, who did we have to watch on in movies? Like these giant jacked guys like Schwarzenegger and Stallone. They were jacked. They looked great. They always said the right thing. They always had the perfect line. So growing up as like a short kid like me, I loved watching those movies, but they totally made me feel like a loser, because it's like I'm nothing like those guys. I'm trying to be those guys, and so I got so over this whole macho thing back in the 90s, and that's why I tend to write more like, you know, loser characters, not loser characters, but people who just aren't like that macho, you know.
But they're also cliche. Action, and they're funny, and they're doing stuff that do action heroes do, but they're flawed and they're funny in a lot of ways, and that's what I kind of loved about Buffy. Not that she was the loser, but she was the flawed funny and kicked ass.
And they call themselves on it. They know that they're flawed.
Yeah.
They're not just, yeah.
And that's fun. So anyway, I don't know how we got on that subject, but there you go.
No. This is the way it is. Welcome to the Express. Well, there's an interesting thing with Sky and I talked about, or Steven Sky and I talked about Rocky a bit, and it was like rewatching that series, and that first Rocky movie is such a masterpiece, and it's all about Adrian. It's weird, like, because I think 70s movies were so brilliant. I mean, I think the 70s are a golden age of cinema. Even some of the worst movies from the 70s, I will be like, oh my God, this movie's awesome. And like Rocky 1 was all about the relationship of Rocky and Adrian. And Rocky's 2, 3, and 4, I mean, they're fine. But they're fun 80s movies that are all about fucking Reagan's USA and being the macho guy. And you know, I mean, Rocky's more in love with Apollo in Rocky 3.
Oh, yeah. That's a relationship story.
And Adrian is very much shunted to the background.
Yeah,
and we kind of saw that in the 80s, I think, with some of these movies you're talking about. Is that the man steps up, and we're like you said, we're going to stop the big bad Russians, and you just stand behind. And then the 90s, I think, is when we've seen where we just talked about Buffy and things like that, and when it's like that's not really the way the world works anymore.
Right.
I feel like we've lost it here and there, but maybe we didn't lose it. I just think we didn't have such a strong show like Buffy, or I know it's syndicated, but like Xena, which was huge. And then it kind of, then we had like all these wacky little shows like, you know, Dollhouse and Birds of Prey and all these small things that came in and out and didn't stay. But like, we haven't had that kind of strength again in a long time. And I'm probably forgetting a show here and there, but not as distinct as that in the 90s. I kind of want that to come back now.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think there's an element of, I don't know if you could have pulled off a female action lead in the 80s. I don't know if you could have. I don't know if the culture would have.
I agree. I don't know if they were, you know.
Totally agree with you.
But she did in the 70s, which is so strange. But anyway.
That was right out of the 60s, though, where it was more like, you know, hey, you know.
Something happened in the 80s where it went up in the 70s and down in the 80s and back up in the 90s and down in the 2000s, and here we are.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think macho is the word Tom brought up. That's a good one. I mean, it was such a macho era. It's actually really ridiculous when you look back on it. You know, it's really so stupid. And some of this stuff is going on. And, hey, I was cheering on Hulk Hogan, too. I was a Hulk Hogan back and everything. But there's something about it that was like, I mean, we had to put up such a strong front. I mean, it's easy to forget the 80s was a time of quote-unquote war. I mean, grew up in the shadow of nuclear annihilation. And, you know, The Day After by Nicholas Meyer and everything was like the scariest TV movie of all time.
That's right, yeah. And then, yeah, that's why we had G.I. Joe, the big mass guys to protect us from all that crap in the 80s. So.
And
macho.
But nowadays, I think we know it's different. Like, I think if Zoe Saldana did a comic book movie and was a star. I mean, I think she was one of the best parts of both Guardians and Star Trek, the new ones.
Yeah.
I think she's just phenomenal. And not just because she's hot, but she's kick-ass, and she's a phenomenal actress, and she's talented. She knows what to do, the right things to do. She's the little things well, the big things well. And she could absolutely, I think, launch an action franchise or a comic book movie franchise. And I think the thing that Hollywood needs to learn, and I think they're learning it, I don't think they've learned it yet, meaning the suits and the decision makers and stuff. I think Marvel gets it. I think many of the TV executives get it, is that male viewers are not alienated by female leads.
Right. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
And I think that was a big fear for a long time.
I totally agree. Yes. Yeah.
Especially, I mean, Orange is the New Black. Why would I like that?
Right.
But it's one of the greatest shows I've ever seen. You know, I've said that a million times on the show. So you're welcome, Genji and everybody.
The only reason you like that show is because it's a bunch of lesbians in prison having sex.
Well, now, here's the thing. No, that's the thing. It's a bunch of, you know, it's very realistic.
No, I know. Yeah.
It's not.
No, we love it.
It's not Jonathan.
No, we absolutely love it.
It's not Jonathan Demme's Caged Heat 2.
No.
Or sorry. It's not Emmanuel is the New Black. I don't know what these movies are.
I know Emmanuel. I'm well versed in this 80s Skinamax movies of Emmanuel.
Hulk Hogan, Rocky, and Emmanuel.
I'm out of this one, man. I'm backing out.
Yeah, right. Well, anyway, let's go back, though. How did you guys get started in the world of animation? What were your guys' breaks as becoming people who were actually writing scripts for cartoons?
Yeah, okay, well, I had started off, actually, I was at Paramount. I was an assistant to a guy named Dan O'Shannon, who was a producer on Modern Family and for many years, and Cheers and Frasier. He was the best boss I ever had. I was his assistant for like a year. His development deal was up, and he left, and I needed a job. And so somehow I ended up at Nickelodeon submitting my resume. And I never thought about getting into animation, although I loved animation, but I needed a job. So they hired me on as a script coordinator on a show called Chalk Zone, which was a kid's like preschool show. Started off there as a script coordinator, and then just kept moving up, getting script jobs on a show called Cat Scratch, and then The Fairly Odd Parents. And from there, just like steamrolled. You just get more credits, you get a manager. They help get you some more stuff. But that was like back in like 2002 that I got into Nickelodeon. Nickelodeon was my big break, and I'm like super grateful because I had a great time there. But yeah, starting off as a script coordinator was my big move.
I'm going to ask you what I asked you. What exactly is a script coordinator?
A script coordinator is someone who basically just looks after the scripts. So you have, you know, the writers who sit in their room and they talk about stories and jokes. And then they hand you a script, and you're just responsible with handing it out to the executives or making copies. You're basically just like, you know.
It's a writer's assistant equivalent.
It's kind of like a writer's assistant, but just a different
name. They just call it a different name in animation.
That's a better title, though.
Yeah. So, and, you know, you take notes in the meetings, too. So, yeah, you really are a writer's assistant. But it's the best way to get in and get known with the writers is by being the writer's assistant or script coordinator. So, yeah, that's what I did, and it's been great ever since. Super great. Wicked great, as we say in Boston. Absolutely. Wicked great. That's my story. The end.
All right. Tim? Well, thanks for listening.
What else do you want to know about me, Tim?
Well, I think it's interesting that one of the things that's always good to hear about this, and this is, it's like, you know, I think some of us are, you talk to so many writers like, I have to sell a show. I have to get staffed. Well, sometimes there are back doors and back ways into it. And I think I've seen it countless times in the industry of people who get a job that is far from ideal or maybe an entry level or a step down and they think, ugh, Christ, here we go. You know, as opposed to not realizing that, hey, guess what? That's actually an opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, that's a way in. That's a door. Take, you know, if you can see a path, even if it's a few steps back, if you can see a path from that.
Yeah. You need to, especially if you're starting out in this business. You can't just become a writer right away. You can't. I mean, unless you're super lucky or you have some amazing connections, you can. You have to start either at the bottom, and you got to just do it. Everybody does it, and it's the best way to even just make connections for the future. So, I mean, you're starting at the bottom with other people and moving your way up with them, and it's the best way to make bonds and eventually become a writer, no matter how far back you are in the system.
Yeah.
I'm always surprised by people who are like that as well. Like, I had a roommate about 12 years ago. We were still really young, and he refused to take a job as a script coordinator or writer's assistant, and I suggested it to him all the time. He was a great comedy writer. He just didn't want to do it because he thought he was above it or something. And I'm, you know, now here he is 12 years later. He had to move back home, got a totally different job that has nothing to do with writing comedy at all because he was, like, stubborn. So,
yeah,
you got to do it.
That's a great cautionary tale there, because nowadays, I mean, people are stabbing themselves in the street to get a writer's assistant job. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
They're almost as in demand as getting a writer's job. But at the same time, there's other ways of getting on set, like being a PA.
Yeah, everything.
Like being an assistant to an executive or a producer or things like that. Those are great ways to jump. Once you're in the room, and I don't even mean in the writer's room, just like in the building.
Yeah.
It's a huge opportunity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the most valuable thing you can do. So,
because, well, here's the other thing, too. What's interesting, too, is you keep talking about Nickelodeon, But so you bounced around from show to show to show, or how did that work?
And network.
Yes, I did. I bounced around from shows at Nickelodeon, because some would either I'd be freelancing on some shows and then get hired as a staff writer on some other shows, and then I mean, the Nickelodeon, you know, tends to move some of their writers around, which is cool. So if you're in there, you're in there. You can go from show to show. Lots of networks do that. You know, Cartoon Network does that. Same with Disney. It's kind of normal. But, yeah, I just happened to be unlucky where I was on a show as a staff writer, and it got canceled, and they just let all of us go. So they bring me back for freelance jobs still.
Right.
But, yeah.
That's why you moved to Cartoon Network.
That's why I moved to Cartoon Network. I'm there now actually doing a lot of great freelance and stuff for Cartoon Network, helping them develop two shows, actually. One I'm writing the Bible for. Now we all know what a show Bible is. I'm writing a show Bible for one of their shows and the pilot for another show for a series. So, yeah, a lot of animation writers these days are really freelance writers. The
staff is harder to come.
Yeah.
People love to freelance these days. Well, okay, let's put it this way. The executives and the budgets want freelance rather than now staffing these days. In animation anyway. I'm sure it's different in live action.
Yeah,
but
animation has just changed. When I started,
yes,
they would hire a lot of staff writers. Now they know they can save money by just instead of paying you your weekly salary plus a script fee, they'll just pay you a script fee and you can work from home. So it's a little tougher now. Yeah,
and it's a shame because that writer's room is really important. But they'll have about two or three in-house writers, and then the rest are freelance.
Yeah.
So there's still that writer's room, but all those freelancers don't necessarily get to be in that writer's room, and it's just not the same.
It's not the same. And Tim, you're right. Like it is. Like we've both been really successful being freelance writers. We work from home. It's great. I have no worries or anything. But I miss being in that room constantly and having the energy. Like especially with cartoons, which is kind of like. It's supposed to be like a fun, visual, goofy environment, and it always was when I was in a room with the writers at a studio. But now that I'm working from home, it's just you kind of miss out on that. So freelancing is great because, yes, I can do a lot of it and work for a bunch of different shows and different networks, but you kind of just miss the energy.
Yeah, and it's also cool to be in like buildings where other shows are going on. And
yeah.
You make friends with the other shows, and you all go out to lunch and compare what are you guys going through. Oh, we got this, we got that. It's,
yeah, and then they'll hire you for freelance on that show if you're in there. So yeah, it's kind of a bummer, but I mean the
business changes. I mean it happens, and it goes through phases, and it goes up and down, and that's where we're at right now in the business. I think.
Yeah.
Now what is I don't think I've ever read an animation script, and I imagine like because you talked about economy of words there, but what sort of Like, what is exactly is the process? This may sound like a stupid question, but like, okay, you write the script. How do the animators know like what to draw, or is that a director's interpretation? Like, how much are you guys like writers versus directors, or are you guys just literally dialogue jokes and the direction of the story? You know what I mean?
Okay, it's interesting you bring that up. Like, when I first started writing animation, I would write like a script, and then I would see what the artist has done. Usually, the script gets handed off to the actual storyboard artist, not the director. So the storyboard artist takes your script and then the audio that they've recorded, and then they'll just do the storyboard based on that. And then I would see the storyboard or the animatic, and I'd be like, hey, wait a minute. The voiceover actors didn't say the joke the way I kind of expected them to. The storyboard artist did not draw that gag the way that's, it's the way it's supposed to be for maximum funny. So that's why I had to teach myself to make my scripts as detailed as possible, so that way they would do it. And it's worked a lot better for me now because of that. But what was your question?
The nuts and bolts of it. Like, how does it go from like, I write the script to how does it go to get drawn? Like, how does the animator know what to do? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and I guess you did answer that. So
yeah. I mean, there's obviously a lot of meetings that we used to do. I don't know if they do this anymore. When I started Nickelodeon, my producer, he was an old-school animation writer and artist from Hanna-Barbera, and he would do something called a handout. So he would call in the artist, and he would hand them the script and the EMR, which is the dialogue recording from the record session, and he would explain to them how to do some certain things, like, I need this like this, that like that, here's some artwork to follow, here's some character models, blah, blah, blah. I don't know if they do that necessarily as much anymore. I think the storyboard artist tends to draw.
I mean, the directors have a meeting. I mean, there's a full meeting for this stuff when they, they first, then they'll do the thumbnail pitch, and then there's like little thumbnail, meaning little drawings
that
they'll do, and they'll do a whole pitch to that. And then the EP will be like, this is not working, that's not working, we need to see this here, you got to push that, right, make this drawing looser. So there's steps to all of this.
Yeah, I forgot about that. The thumbnail pitch is super important. Yeah, yes. That's a good point, honey. Yeah, good call. You're smart.
Thanks.
And hot.
Thanks.
I love you.
Yay.
I think that's the first I love you on the Express.
So. I love you too, Tim.
But I'm just wondering, so like when you write a script, in other words, you don't have to fill the frame. You know what I mean? With what's being drawn. Like you don't have to say, okay, 10 Decepticons are flying over this hill. Yeah. And it's got to be like.
It's very specific to 10 Decepticons killing. Like they need to count that. Or like unless it's so specific where it needs to be said because of the script.
Right.
And no. Yeah. Yes. But then no, if not. You know what I mean? It's you don't need that. No.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Right. Also, you got to be careful because there's jokes in the business where you're like, Steve Marmel, this amazing animation writer now, he's in live action and he's a brilliant comedian. And he used to joke on Fairly Odd Parents. I think he'd be like, write like 10 unicorns flying on rainbows with ponies like raining, like puppies raining down. So you gotta, don't be too complicated in animation. You gotta be careful because these people have to draw this shit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's another thing that he always joked about. Like,
don't be complicated.
Yeah, like don't draw like 10 unicorns on rainbows, like raining magic down on this crazy thing. Because so you do have to actually be careful on how you write things in that way, which is probably. I mean, I guess that would be similar for live action. I guess you don't want to do anything nutty that doesn't adhere to the budget. I suppose on shows, I would think.
Well, that's gonna be the line producer stepping in.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it does happen, though. You've got to be careful what you write, because you do. You do have to watch that stuff.
Yeah, you know, the hardest one to write for is a CG show, you know, a 3D, you know.
Very difficult.
It's such a difficult cartoon to write for, because that's where the money comes involved. That's where the budget is really strained.
Truly.
I used to work on a show called Tack and the Power of Juju at Nickelodeon, and that was Nickelodeon's first, like, true CG show. And it's really expensive to create new models for new characters and new props. And you can't show water being splashed around because that's expensive. So you can't get all your gags across when you write a script in CG because it's so expensive. So you kind of actually also have to learn to adhere to, okay, what's the funniest thing I can write in a CG show that's not going to be expensive but will be super funny?
I think it's better these days a little bit, but it depends on the budget of the show. You can't do water. You can't have splashing mud. You can't have too many clouds. You can't have rain.
You can't have certain amount of number of characters on the screen, like you were saying, Tim. Like that's one where you could get in trouble, like saying, "Oh, there has to be 10 Decepticons in this scene." You can't do that. It's too expensive.
Yeah, we got a budget for two.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, exactly.
I mean, you got Starscream and Soundwave. That's it, guys.
Write out all the other Decepticons.
Or they just nod and hum.
Yeah, no,
yeah,
I mean,
that's it.
Luckily, I get some work on some shows nowadays that are CG, like Max Steel on Disney XD. And I think that still plays in Australia, actually. Max Steel. Nice. And, like, that's a CG show, but, like Jen was saying, it has come a little farther where now they have, you know, technology makes it a little easier, I guess, to come up with models and characters that aren't as expensive. But Max Steel was great. They would give us a lot of freedom because it was a Disney show and a lot of merchandise behind that.
Sure.
Which is great. But
ten years ago, it was very different. So a lot has changed on that.
Still expensive, though.
But they still watch it. They still have to watch it.
Yeah.
So I may be repeating what we talked about before, but you've got to have – see, it's not just the economy awards that you have to have in your guys' animation scripts, but the specificity of what is absolutely necessary to the story. Because these guys have to draw, like, you have to give them, look, these things have to end up on the screen. If they don't, the story doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And that's actually really, like you're saying, a really great discipline and a great way for every screenwriter to think about, like, look, what you should be writing in your description is the stuff that absolutely has to be on screen. If it doesn't have to be there.
Right.
You know, don't, and one thing I always love hearing people say is do not production design in a screenplay.
Yeah,
do not costume design in a screenplay. Don't do makeup in a screenplay. You're the writer.
Yeah.
You know, if you write, you can write, you know, what has to, like, in other words, if a woman is dressed for an evening out and you could just write her and, you know, so-and-so walks in an evening dress or whatever, we can play with that. But if she absolutely has to have a necklace on that will be stolen, that turns out to be the MacGuffin that everybody chases, then you have to put that in the script kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, if there's a joke, for example, if like the lady's in ridiculous high heels where she could barely walk, that'd be great for the animator to know that.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
Okay. So they're walking like stupid, ridiculous, and it's silly. Mm-hmm. But that gives them something. I mean, I've seen scripts where if you're too vague, that's so not good. And then you're like, well, the artists have nothing to work with. They're like, there's a chase. And like, what does that mean? There's a chase. You got to give a little something. Yeah. So there's a balance.
Yeah.
I think of not giving too much and you know, and not giving nothing is no good.
Yeah, it's hard because I think sometimes I think sometimes I like to think that everybody else can interpret my words the way I want them to be interpreted when I write them. Obviously not when I speak because I'm a terrible speaker. So I think I give them the benefit of the doubt and I think, oh, the director will understand this no matter how much I think I've written it in as much detail as I can.
I think sometimes some directors love that and some directors hate
that.
Yeah, yeah. It really just depends on who you're working with too. So, you know, every scenario is kind of different in some way. I mean, there's certain rules, but if you can find a balance, you're going to be pretty safe.
So it almost sounds like the artist, the way you guys are talking about the artist interpreting the script, are they, like, it almost sounds like the way live action talks about actors, even though you guys are dealing with actors as well.
Right.
Right. You know? And the voice actors, of course.
Right.
So.
But now you say it usually goes, you write the script, and then the recording happens, and then the animation happens?
Correct.
I almost would have thought it would be the other way around, to have the animation done so that you could then bring, or like temp in VO, and then do the animation, and then have
there's the animatic as well. There's the animatic, which is, you know, so it'd be, what would it be? I guess it'd be script. Well, it'd be the writer's room, then the script, then voiceover, and then animatic put together from the, you know, from the, they put the radio play track together, and then the animatic would happen, and then it goes to animation. So there, it's a huge collaborative process because honestly, as a writer, you're creating the world, and then as the voiceover, they're creating it, and then the animator adds to that too. Yeah. So it's like a three-prong process in terms of actually having your dialogue become something.
Yeah, exactly.
It really does make those three factors are huge.
Yeah, Tim, were you saying that you would have assumed we would have done the artwork first? Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, like, I'd almost assume to have the cartoon kind of done so that the anime, like the voiceover actors, could see it as they do.
You know,
but that doesn't work.
No, it can. That's how they used to do it back in the old days, like the old Popeye cartoons. I believe it was the Popeye cartoons. They would do the animation first, then literally just go in there and talk and do his Popeye voice.
Right.
Terrible Popeye voice. Yeah. But when I was at Nickelodeon, the way you're talking right now, Tim, that's how I thought they did it. Because when I was at Nickelodeon, the show I was on was called Chalk Zone, and we did exactly that. The artist would take the script without any dialogue, and he would draw the full storyboard based on the script without having any dialogue, and then we would take that storyboard into the record session, and the voiceover people would act off the storyboard.
Wow.
That was very uncommon, but my boss was an old Hanna-Barbera guy, and that's how he did it, and that's how it worked. And it worked for us on that show. No other show at Nickelodeon, I think, did that at the time or does that at all. I mean, now.
And
but
then,
you can do it.
And SpongeBob goes to the extreme where it's an outline. There's no scripts.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you want
to
talk.
No, you probably know
better,
actually.
Well, you know those guys, so.
I thought you knew them. Okay.
I do, absolutely. No, I mean, the bottom line is they do an outline as opposed to a full script. I mean, right? How many pages is the outline, Tom?
I don't know, four maybe.
Yeah, so
two to four pages.
And the board artists take it and draw. They're a big part of the writing. The artists on that show is, I guess we call it a there's a writers driven show and there's a storyboard driven show.
Yep, it's a board driven.
Board driven show is what they call it these days.
Yeah, those artists, they give them. I mean, on a visual show like that, it's nice to give the artists a lot of freedom to come up with whatever gags and story stuff they want to. A lot of shows like that are a lot more shows are board-driven.
Are board-driven
nowadays.
These
days.
At
Cartoon Network, I think that's how Adventure Time is. I think Adventure Time, which is a hugely popular show, is board-driven. They let the artists have fun. They come up with the whole board, then they record everything afterwards.
They come
cringe.
Up with actual jokes, like written jokes.
Yeah, it's smart.
That
it's
didn't
fun.
Exist in the outline.
Yeah.
And then, but as far as dialogue goes, I mean, is it just sort of a like quasi-improv in those outlines, or there's actually dialogue in there?
No, there's dialogue in there. They'll create the script off of that.
No, but they'll actually do dialogue.
Oh, yeah, they will. I'm sorry. Yeah, the artist will put dialogue in there.
In a board-driven show.
Yeah.
Yes. Which is, so there's like kind of three kinds. I guess the old school one you were talking about.
Yeah.
And then a board-driven show like SpongeBob, and then the traditional show, which is what we usually do.
Yeah.
Do you guys see animation becoming, I don't know, you're saying the budgets are going down on some of those CG shows and stuff like that. Like, everybody knows The Simpsons and Family Guy, but there's also, you know, Archer.
Yeah.
Which is very, very highly regarded. And in fact, many people have come out and said, listen, this may be the most realistic spy show out there. Because it's crazy. It's a it's an insane world. And, right. You know, we all want to think it's James Bond and stuff, but it's actually really quite mad.
Yeah.
And nuts. And there's people who've come out and said, Archer is really realistic, actually, which is crazy.
Wow. Yeah.
And scary to think about. I mean, do you see that becoming more of... is animation on primetime going to become more mainstream, or is it just going to sort of maintain its niche, do you think?
Man.
You mean adult?
Yeah, like for adults. Like, in other words, people are just going to watch... Like, I'll watch Blacklist, and then I'll watch Game of Thrones, then I'll watch Archer. You know, like, it's...
I mean, it is becoming more mainstream, I guess, which is good. You have a lot of, you know, the Fox animated primetime series and stuff, but...
And Adult Swim has its... I mean, it hasn't gone away. I mean, they've done some more live action now, which I appreciate, but I don't know. So that's a really good question.
I think that depends on the executives in charge at specific networks. I mean, you could have a lot more great primetime animated series on the air if they would just greenlight them, and then it would be much more... you know, normal to see a lot of adults watching the primetime sitcoms. They're not greenlighting them. They don't want them because you're right. They have like their blacklists. They have a lot of their live action shows. There's no need to, I guess, in their minds, greenlight.
And
more.
Some have failed, and that's because but they blame animation sometimes, where it's not animation. It's what they've chosen, or because a celebrity has a voice on it or has created it, and they want to do it. Oh, and then they wonder why it failed. Oh, well, no one likes animation.
Right.
And it's
right.
like no, yes. It's because you probably developed something that didn't work because you threw someone on it or a voice or because they're popular, not because it's good.
Very good.
And that's an important part too. So I think it'll stay a niche unless people stop doing that. And I don't know if executives will ever stop doing that. Now, when you pitch a primetime animation, they want to see a final product. They actually want to see a pilot or at least a heavy animatic where it's almost animated.
Yeah.
So that's also become an issue where you can't go in with a primetime script of animation. They want to actually see stuff or have a name attached, or else they won't even really look at you too much.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it's going to be stay a niche unless these people end up having something amazing, then they come in and they get lucky. I think it's going to be a luck of the draw of someone who has a really good show and happens to have an actor attached and happens to have a name attached and happens to be good and they happen to get lucky. You see how it goes there? That's when the problem arises.
Also, I think that if like a major network were to get like an executive, hire an executive who came from animation, like from Nickelodeon or Disney, then that executive would be more likely to remind them, hey, you should do something. Like,
or they know what they're doing.
Yeah, the experience to do it, exactly. So I'm sure a lot of those execs are obviously from the live action world and grew up in live action, so they're...
And I'm sure there's middle executives who do see value, but then there's always someone above them who they have to try to convince. So, I mean... I don't know who's to blame particularly, but there's just a process that sometimes things get lost in. And so I don't know. I think it might remain a niche until that changes.
I blame Drago.
I do too. It's funny. My favorite season of the original Star Trek is actually the animated one.
Oh, really?
I really do. I think that's the best. I think the 30-minute nice, the tight storytelling and everything, and they could do actual aliens and real special effects.
Right.
I thought that really was, it's been my favorite.
It's on Netflix right now. We should watch
it. I've been wanting a new Star Trek animated series in some way, shape, or form for years, and I think it would be brilliant, but everyone does Star Wars, which is wonderful, because they don't think, well, the 12-year-old doesn't give a damn about Star Trek, so it's hard for them to connect and do that, so they've never thought of doing that, but awesome. I would have absolutely loved to see it, and I think it'd be brilliant.
Well, unfortunately, that brand, before JJ got a hold of it, was pretty damaged.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it really was. It took a couple of... took a couple of beatings there for a second.
Yes. And then you damaged it again with Star Trek Into Darkness. Yeah.
That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah. Whole other conversation. You know, I like the JJ movies, but I think he very smartly made it a sister universe type thing, so that if you don't like them, you can just ignore them and you still have your Star Trek canon.
I guess
that was smart. Now, you guys, though, are actually talking about moving away from animation. You're starting to write some more live-action things and stuff like that.
Yeah.
What genres are you guys looking at getting into?
For me, I mean, it's definitely fantasy, sci-fi, hopefully female driven, whether it be dramedy or comedy or action. I mean, in that blend, as long as it's something interesting, I have no problem going full fledged drama or a hint of dramedy. I always like a hint of sense of humor in anything, even if it is a drama. I can't help it. I need that. Maybe I come from the Joss school of putting a little something in there, but I don't think there's anything wrong with that particularly. But I mean, I do love action comedy, but a female driven in a sci-fi fantasy world, I think would be fantastic. I know that's such a rare, weird thing, but I think it's up and coming. But I've been doing that for 10 years, but maybe I'm at the right place at the right time. We'll see. I don't know, but I love that. But I also love the drama part of that too. I always will. So yeah, that's what I love to do.
Yeah.
It's so funny. I was just going to say real quick, we had 30 Rock. Not 30 Rock. Third Rock from the Sun.
Oh, yes.
Which was a proper sci-fi sitcom. That's probably... And when Mork and Mindy was a sci-fi sitcom, but America's never had like a Red Dwarf.
I love Red Dwarf.
Like Red Dwarf is one of my favorite things ever. And there's... I mean, it just doesn't exist. I don't even know how... I mean, they tried to do an American one, as you probably know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's like they just can't get that. I would be the happiest human being on this planet if I could make something that would straddle that genre and make that happen, like Third Rock, but in more of a Red Dwarf way. I could live happy forever.
Yeah.
If I could do that one thing,
it'd be awesome.
Yeah. I'd be thrilled. But anyway, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't want to interrupt you, Tom.
But what am I talking about?
Talk about Red Dwarf. What's your favorite season?
The kind of genre that you like.
Oh, the kind of genre that I like.
Looking at you.
The live action stuff, yes. I want to write. Well. I love my sitcoms, whether they're, you know, multi-cam or single cam. I think I tend to lean towards single cam sitcoms right now. We've been having some headway now with the script that was that won the competition this past year. It's opened up a lot of doors for me in the live action world, which is great. And there is a network interested.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, so we're going to see what happens with that. I'm going to hopefully talk with them this week. But I don't know, just like I love good family comedies like Goldberg's and The Middle. That's kind of what I tend to lean towards. But now I'm writing kind of like a dirtier half hour comedy for like Netflix. Kind of like it's really pretty, not dirty. It's just more a lot of swearing.
More risque.
Yeah. So that's
but really action comedy, I guess, with a, or really family comedy, I guess. So those two genres, pretty much.
Yeah. Any live action feature that I write is generally like a stepbrothers kind of comedy, like a dumb buddy comedy, because I love dumb comedy, and that's what I also tend to write, just really stupid guys doing dumb things.
But there's also a reason why people love it, and there are some smart things in there. Stepbrothers has some really smart, funny things in there that isn't dumb. It's supposed to be dumb on purpose, and that's what...
It's brilliant.
So it just depends if that's your thing.
Yeah.
One of my favorite new shows is Black-ish.
Last week's episode, yeah.
It's really good. They talk about really topical things. They don't hide from the racial issues.
Right.
But it doesn't alienate you. As like a white viewer, it's not like, oh, this is a black show, guys. No. This is very much a normal human family show about, you know, next door and all that. And but they did a gag the other week, I think it was last week, where a guy walked into a glass door holding four coffees. And you know something? I've seen it before. I will see it again, and I will laugh all three times. It was
execution.
It's just, what's wrong? And you know, a lot of people run down Last Man Standing with Tim Allen, but it survived.
Yeah,
it survived a lot of axe falls, and there's something about just the family unit. What's the family going through? What are they talking about these days?
Right.
That just I mean, Family Ties is my favorite sitcom of all time.
Oh man, yeah,
you know, first, Tom.
Michael J. Fox is my idol as a kid because he was short and successful.
The height thing aside, Tom and I are like lived parallel lives, actually, that we have to explore further at one point as wrestling Doctor Who fans who love Family Ties and who write stuff.
That's a sitcom right there.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, cool. Well, listen, actually, we are getting pretty close to time right now.
Nice.
So I want to thank Tom Krajewski. Huh?
It's Krajewski.
Liar!
That's not
fine. Krajewski, yes,
no, you're absolutely correct.
Tom Krajewski, don't let the spelling fool you guys. And Jen Miro.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for joining us very much.
Dude, thanks for having me.
This was super fun. Thank you for having us.
It was great talking and venting and feeling important.
You've given us closure. I appreciate that.
Yeah. No, sure. That's what I'm here to do is provide closure. Yeah, no, and this is just really, like, really useful stuff about, for anybody out there who's aspiring, who's working on your first script or running what to do in Hollywood, listen to what these guys were saying. You don't have to wait for permission. If you look for opportunities that are there that you may not realize. Hollywood's rolling out the red carpet for the A-listers, and until you're one of them, you're not an A-lister, so don't wait for the red carpet.
Yeah. And good advice, Tim.
Good advice. Great advice.
No, that's from you guys. So thank you all very much. Don't hang up, though. We got some housekeeping. And then want to thank everybody for listening, downloading, retweeting, Google Plusing, Pinteresting. I don't know if anybody's posting this on LO yet. You could be the first. Thanks so much for listening. We've got a lot of fun holiday programming coming up, including later on this week. I think we're going to be talking about Snack Friday. We're going to try to get that going. For people who hate Black Friday and shopping, we're going to be talking about Snack Friday, which is... have you guys heard about Snack Friday?
No.
I want in, though, whatever it is.
Instead of going to, like, you know, some big corporate retailer and buying stuff that you could probably get cheaper either this week or the week after, take some time on Friday, go out and get some canned goods and bring them to a local, you know, food shelter or a local charity or things like that. And because that is really what the holidays is all about, is giving to people in need and giving stuff like that. So, yeah, it's a quasi-invention of a friend of mine, and we're trying to get it some more publicity and get it out there some more this year.
Awesome.
So we're going to be talking about that later on this week. And and now we got two recruits who are going to be talking about it.
Nice. Absolutely.
So thank you very much for listening, and we will see you. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you soon on the Handsome Timmy D Express.